KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Good morning to you, good afternoon, good day, whoever you may be, wherever you might be. Welcome to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, Mid-Missouri source for in-depth news, diverse talk, wonderful music, and lots of good stuff. Tune it in here to 89.5 whenever you get a chance. We'll do it tonight, all night. Another extremely action-packed program for you. But before all of that excitement, a quick thank you to Corey and New Wave Radio Theater, Moon Over Morocco. I think episode 8 out of 10. We got a couple weeks left, and we'll see what Corey comes up with after that. But wonderful stuff. A lot of people enjoying Moon Over Morocco, myself included. Thank you to Corey for doing that. And every week, 1 hour before this program at 10 p.m., you can hear it, New Wave Radio Theater with Corey. Wonderful stuff. All right. Kelvin and Jason tonight, doing it up before that. Jazz plus blues equals the fifth night. Tech Radio from 6 until 7. They keep us up on the amazing landscape of high technology. Jeff Wheeler starting things off with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Good music, good talk, good news. A radio riot on a chilly Monday night. Moon at nearly full, but slipping away. Amazing full moon, by the way, last Saturday night, and some amazing formations up there in the heavens right now. Speaking of Saturday night and KOPN, I got to say, you know, there's great radio on KOPN all the time, and I always mention the Monday night shows, but Saturday night I was driving in from Kentucky. I was there for the Thanksgiving holiday, and driving back in when we got into range, I heard some of the music from James Tucker Smith's show called The Time Slip. On Saturday, starts at 11 p.m., goes until 2, and it was just incredible, just really awesome radio program. And after that, Kyle and Tony and their whole gang doing Mystery Science Radio 3000. It comes out at 2 o'clock in the morning on Sunday morning, I guess, late Saturday night, early Sunday morning. But between James Tucker Smith and Kyle and Tony, those two programs, The Time Slip and Mystery Science Radio 3000, from 11 p.m. on Saturday night until 5 in the morning. I mean, just outrageous radio and great music and some very fun and interesting, funny stuff that the guys do late in the night. But anyway, KOPN doing some really cool stuff. And, you know, a lot of people out there that listen to my program don't listen to radio on Saturday night, or they don't listen to KOPN, you know, on a regular basis. You know, maybe they listen to my show over the web or something like that and just tune in on Mondays. But there's some real good stuff throughout the week here, and I sure encourage people to check that out. And certainly Saturday night, Sunday morning is one of the highlights. So anyway, like I said, Saturday night we had a great full moon. It was a beautiful night, and we've been really fortunate with the weather. A little bit chilly right now, but still a nice night. And it's the 26th of November already. And you're listening to it here on KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM, your imagination station. It's great to be here with y'all and part of it. And, you know, thanks to everybody who joined us last week as well. A healthy and posthumous thank you to Mr. Terrence McKenna. We heard some of the good old words of Terrence last week. 17 years old, actually, the words we heard last week from 1990, but fresh as this morning for sure. So thanks again to Terrence. We are all richer for you, my brother. And music also last week from John Cale. Awesome stuff. Great show and a blast for me to do it. So thanks to everyone involved. By the way, the musicians that are featured on the program can be found on the website right over in the music archives. And, you know, you can check them out if you like, all right? And also, if you missed last week's show, or any other for that matter, you can always hear them after the fact. They're all on the web at www.mikehagan.com in the program archives. So slip on over there and take a look around, see what you think. Find something you might think is interesting for yourself and share it with others. Maybe they might like it. Okay. All right, tonight, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher at midnight. We'll have Star Newland and Dr. Michael Heisen sometime during this first hour. I'll probably play a piece of music here in a minute and try to get them on the line. But I got a few things to talk about, I guess, before we do that. But at any rate, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher at midnight, Star Newland and Dr. Michael Heisen in just a few minutes, and the music of John Condren and The Benefit throughout the show tonight. John Condren and The Benefit, that's what we heard the first song to open the program. And that was actually from a recently released, I guess it's an EP. There's six or seven songs on it. It's called Let You Down. But anyway, John Condren and The Benefit, a group of musicians that I met from Chicago a month or so ago, and doing good stuff. And I'd like to share some of that with you tonight, okay? All right, we'll play another one from John in a few minutes, okay? Let's see. What else? Let me say hello to everybody. If you're listening over the web, hello in the chat room. Hello to everybody listening over the traditional waves. Every Monday we do this from the studios of KOPN in downtown Columbia, Missouri. We stream the show on the web. We stream the show on the internet at www.kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button, and you can hear the show and any of the other programs on KOPN anywhere you have a decent internet connection. So thanks to everyone who makes it happen, live on the radio, live on the net, and thanks to my friend Larry, the wonderful web wizard, who's done a whole lot to help me lately and always does, and doing great stuff as always. Got a lot of other good projects, a lot of other interesting and fun projects as well, Larry Norringer does. So check him out, send him a note, say thanks if you ever get a chance, all right? Okay, if you're an artist of any variety, get in touch with me. I like to see what you're doing, listen to what you're doing, and find a way to share it with other people if we can, okay? There's places on the website for all this stuff, and although we're not up to snuff as we should be, don't think I'm losing any of this stuff, and we'll eventually get all of this interesting stuff that you all are doing and sharing with me up on the web so we can share it with other people, okay? All right, the website, by the way, Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. Slip on over there. You'll have access to everything that we're doing, and you can share your thoughts with us. There's a forum, a bulletin board that's always busy, and lots of interesting topics up there. Not all of them interesting. Some sort of silly and whatever, but, you know, that's the nature of things, and it's a whole little community that's cool and fun and interesting. So if you want, take a look at the forum sometime. If you go over to the website, just click on the Radio Orbit forum, and you can go see what people are talking about over there. That happens round the clock, and there's a live chat room that's up and active right now during the program. Of course, you can use that anytime during the week as well, but certainly during the program, as it is tonight, there's a group of the usual suspects and some new faces in there as well. But hello to all of you over there, and it's a pleasure to have you listen to the program and able to chat amongst yourselves and sort of interact during the thing. So it's great that we're able to do that, and a big thank you to Chaos for getting the whole chat thing together. He does it every week and does a great job, and I really appreciate it. Okay. We'll peek in there for questions and comments as we go along the program tonight, by the way, okay? I encourage my guests as well as my listeners to join us in the chat and the forum. It's a great way to get to know the people that are listening to you and interact with them as well, okay? All right. My email address, orbitradio@aol.com. Send me email. The guests and musicians that are on the program, send them email as well. You can always find contact information for them on my website, okay? All right. Tonight, the 26th of November, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. We'll also have Dr. Michael Heisen and Star Newland in just a few minutes. The 3rd of December, next week, Paco Almgren, the author of the book Disciple. It's a novel. It's wonderful. Richard Allen Miller on the 10th of December, a couple open weeks that will fill up between now and then Paul Lathley for New Year's. What else do I want to tell you before we go to break here? Announcements. The Comet, P-17 Holmes. Go to Kent Stedman's website, and that's the place to follow this thing. Still amazing things that are happening up there with P-17 Holmes. C-Realm, I want to give a shout-out to my friend KMO, who is a wonderful broadcaster that does a podcast called The C-Realm, and you can find it on the web at C-Realm.com, C-Realm.org. I should know better, but I'm sure you can find it. The C stands for consciousness, but in the 65th installment of KMO's podcast, myself and Dr. Martin Ball joined KMO to talk about all kinds of different stuff, including evolution of media, acceleration of consciousness, shamanism, visionary plants, and the big changes that are sort of upon us. So if you're interested in that, you can check it out at KMO's website, C-Realm. So, thank you very much, KMO. That was a blast. And I think there's some more. Actually, we recorded quite a bit of material, and I think you may put some more of that up in the next week or two. Also, Maria Sabina. Maria Sabina passed to the ancestors on the 22nd of November, 1985. She was 91 years old. If you don't know who she was a Mazatec curandera from Oaxaca, Mexico, who encountered Gordon Wasson and his wife Valentina on a trip that they took to Mexico back in 1955. On the 19th of June, very close to the solstice in 1955, she introduced Gordon and Valentina to psilocybin mushrooms during a healing ceremony that she embarked upon. And Gordon Wasson and his wife, Valentina, became the first Westerners to experience the effects of psilocybin and the mushroom as it was found in Mexico and Central America. Anyway, Gordon Wasson wrote about this experience with Maria Sabina and the psilocybin mushroom in an article for Life magazine, a classic article in Life magazine in 1957. If you can get a hold of that, man, trust me, you want memorabilia that'll be worth something someday, get a copy of Life magazine with Gordon Wasson in 1957. Anyway, in the Christian tradition, Maria Sabina may have been seen as a saint through an indigenous lens, a master shaman. And no matter what the background, Maria Sabina was remarkable and a sacred woman. She was a healer and a messenger who played a part in what eventually will be seen as the salvation, I think, of the human race, actually. And if you're not familiar with her story, you might go look at it. She was so special. So, Maria Sabina, here's to you, my grandmother, Mikunsi. Thank you for your gifts. Just an amazing woman. All right, let's take a break here, and then we'll come back, if I can work out the tech, with Dr. Michael Heisen and Miss Star Newland, okay? All right, in the meantime, let's hear another song here from John Condren and The Benefit. What do we got here for you? This one is called Loud as Silence. It's Michaelis Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM.
Coming too far, soon.
John Condren, and The Benefit. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit and KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. That song was called Loud as Silence. You can find information about John and his band on the web at John Condren, C-O-N-D-R-O-N-J-O-H-N, johncondren.com. And they got the MySpace thing, too. But just go on over there to his website. You can go to my website and then click on over to his. But good music from Chicago, and I appreciate them sharing it with us. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. I've got my good friend Dr. Michael Heisen on the line with me from, I'm normally I would say Pune, Hawaii, but I'm not sure. I'm trying to get Star with us as well, but let's quickly say hello to Mike. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
How are you, my brother?
Good.
What's going on? Where are you at? You in Pune?
Yeah, I'm in Kona this time.
In Kona, okay. Other side of the island?
Yes, we're finishing up a paper that's co-authored with Elizabeth Rauscher.
Yes. And Elizabeth is going to be on the program a little bit later tonight. Hey, all right, Mike, we're going to do something a little bit unprofessional here, so watch this, all right? Hold on. Hello? Hi, Star. I tell you what, can you call me back on the other call-in line, and then I can just pick you up, and you and Michael will be on together? Yep. Area code is 573-443-8255. And we should have you in a minute, okay? No, I just picked up and said hi to Mike. Just call me on that line. I'll pick you up in a minute, okay? All right. So we'll see how this works, but Star should be calling in any minute on the other line there. So
that's good.
Until that happens, thank you. How are you? You're doing okay, and you're working on a paper with Elizabeth. You're doing some work, sort of professional work with Elizabeth and the people over there at the Resonance Project. Is that right? You've been doing that for some time?
Right. I'm one of their consultants part-time. And I just had a joy working with Elizabeth. She's one of the neatest people I've met. And there's a lot of neat people around here, and we're doing some, thankfully, significant physics. And it should lead to some interesting technologies someday. And right now the theory is working out pretty good, and there's still pieces of it that have to be proven and bridged to the regular physics. But anyway, what would you like to know?
Well, I guess... Well, first of all, you know, Elizabeth is going to be on the program in just a little while.
Yes.
Yeah, so she'll be on at the top of the hour, and maybe, I guess, you can talk about anything that might, you know, sort of dovetail with the things that we'll be talking about. I guess I guess I'm very interested in what you're doing there, frankly.
Well, as a neurobiologist, sometimes I wonder myself. On the other hand, I've got a little background in physics, and they need some help with some patent writing and some other technical writing, and now I've gotten into helping with the papers. And I've been doing a lot of net research, basically, on things like the spin of the galaxy. That's one of the big problems I've been pursuing on. It turns out to be the origin of the problem of what they call dark matter.
Mm.
Although we've been looking for it for 70 years, so my personal opinion is that it's a myth, that we've missed something.
Mm.
And maybe what we've missed is would roughly be called the viscosity of space-time. Or frame dragging. You know about this?
No.
Basic experiment. Well. Basic experiment, they take two satellites called the Lagios. They're like spheres with mirrors all over them. And they bounce lasers off of them to tell precisely where they are in their orbits. The first day a year.
Yeah. Aloha.
Hold on a second, Star.
Okay.
Okie dokie.
Well, actually, Michael, we'll get right back to that.
That's right.
But we got it, so I'm glad. Star, hi.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to have you, and as always, our mode of connection is always an interesting one. Tonight is no different. So we've got Michael on his cell phone from Kona. We've got you now on the other side of the island. Are you still in the Pune area?
Yes, I'm in Pune in Pahoa at exactly 19.47, 19.47 as we like to say. North latitude, like right along the hyperdimensional vortex.
Oh, yeah.
Again. And Michael is very close to the same latitude on the other side of the island, so now we're zinging the two sides.
All right. Well, do me a favor. Hang in there just for a second. I want to let Michael sort of wrap up what we're talking about here before we got you on the line. And then we'll find out what you're doing over there, okay?
Okay.
All right, so Michael, first of all, I didn't mean to, when I said I'm wondering what you're doing there, I didn't mean to discount your capabilities, or I just meant what you guys and girls are doing there. I want to know the secrets. I want to know I want to know, you know, the deep stuff. I want to know when we're going to have a device that's going to get us up and out of here, or it's going to eliminate the oil paradigm, or something that's going to be profoundly effective in our cultural morass.
Well, I think it's coming, and I think it's already been here. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah.
There's so many different avenues of research that suggest the ancients, for example, had sources of energy and things like that that we get to tap.
No doubt.
And they were very much into the sacred geometry sort of things.
Yes.
And there's got to be some way that they lifted 500-ton rocks.
Sure.
And 1,800-ton statues. But I think our greatest cranes can do 400 tons, and it might take weeks just to arrange one lift.
Right.
And these guys were able to move 1,800 tons of granite.
Yeah, and a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, and at distances like 150 miles, for example.
Michael, have you ever seen those the enormous stones at Baalbek in Lebanon?
Those are the ones I was thinking of, yeah. Those are the 500-ton ones.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, when you just see the thing, it's like, my God, that's a worked stone. They actually, you know, that's a stone that was cut out of something,
right.
and they moved it. It's remarkable. I mean, it makes the largest stones in Giza look like pebbles, sort of.
Yeah, so yes, we need to know how they did that, and I think we're learning. Tim is a remarkable intuitive and physicist and many other things. He's been a diver, a climber.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth is his co-author and knows relativity theory since the time she was about 15. She taught it to herself in high school. She had Glenn Seaborg on her PhD committee.
Wow.
She went off to do major research in particle physics and worked with Jack Wheeler, who was one of the co-authors of a major heavy book called Gravitation. She knows just about everybody, has been around a long time, just a delightful lady who just knows so many things about physics and math and biology and electromedicine,
yeah.
All kinds of things. And some of her other claims to fame are that she participated in some of the early psi research on remote viewing. And
yeah, she was at SRI with Puharich and a whole bunch of people. Yeah,
yeah, she worked with Puharich and Targ and Putoff.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up with studies of remote viewing where the probability value you get that, well, let's see, you have to assume that nothing happened in your experiment. Then if you get what's called a probability value of 0.05, that says you have a 95% probability that what you thought happened really happened. Okay, there's a 5% chance that it happened just by chance.
Right.
Well, they do the same kind of statistics on some of the remote viewing, and they end up with p-values of 1 over 10 to the 20th, or 1 over 10 to 19 zeros, which is a very tiny number, which means the confidence level on that experiment is extremely high.
Right.
And then she also was able to show psychokinetic effects that would modulate the decay of a radioactive source, plus or minus 4%. There are other confirmations of things like telepathy and changes across time and so on.
Yeah, we're going to talk about some of that stuff for sure.
So she developed what she calls a complex eight-dimensional Minkowski space. And because it's higher dimensional, it can handle things like faster-than-light signals, things like that. And so she wrote a paper called The Speed of Thought about all that. So that'll just give you a starting place.
Well, I can't imagine what you are all in the middle of there at the Resonance Project, and I know Nassim is very bright, and I've interviewed him on the program, and I'd like to have him on again to get an update, you know, from him, what he thinks is happening, and I'm sure we'll do that hopefully sometime in the next couple months, but it'll be a pleasure to talk with Elizabeth, and I thank you and Star both for introducing the two of us. So, speaking of introductions, Star Newland, my friend, hi.
Hi, Michael, aloha.
Aloha, and I'm sorry.
And Michael.
I'm sorry we didn't have it perfectly worked out, but it was okay.
It worked out well. Thanks, Michael.
Now, where are you? You're in the middle of something as well right now.
Well, I am. In fact, I was just walking down the streets of Pahoa to go get the digital video film or whatever tapes for the camera so I can record our entertainment tonight and capture for posterity. The second annual Pahoa celebrates domestic harmony awareness. Since this is a home and this is where it all started. And now I'm making my way back to Shoppers Nightclub, which hosted us last year and is kind enough to host us again this year. We're a fun crowd, though.
What's the latest in your progress with Domestic Harmony and that whole business?
Well, we have really wonderful news to report. First of all, if people go to our website, planetpuna.com, this year, for the first year, we have proclamations from all four mayors of Maui, Oahu, or Honolulu, rather, Kauai, and Hawaii Island. So this is pretty exciting to have all four mayors agree and say such beautiful things about domestic harmony for their people. And, over at Barking Sands at the Navy base there, they've written up domestic harmony in their base newspaper, and plus their ombudsman is going to be bringing up domestic harmony awareness at their base meetings. So I'm really excited about that because I can easily envision that domestic harmony awareness would be an active component in, the recovery of our veterans when they come back from, these really difficult and challenging situations.
I know. They need a lot of support and a lot of help when they come back, both the men and the women, regardless of the agenda of the people that sent them over there,
Right, exactly. To have compassion and,
I agree, Star. You told me that I think at least one of the police chiefs is involved as well. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Chief of Police Lawrence Mahuna, who's really so eloquent and so supportive of domestic harmony awareness that last year, Michael Kastenbaum, our film director guy, filmed like an hour and a half, 2-hour interview with us, Lawrence Mahuna. And he had a lot to say about this subject.
So you got,
I asked him.
So you have four mayors and at least one chief of police on board. That's pretty impressive, frankly.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. Plus the governor.
Mm-hmm.
Last year and other years, we've gotten proclamations from the governor. This year, I was going for the mayors, and I'm still waiting for a resolution from our county council, too.
Oh, I just wanted to throw in the Navy base on top of the mayors and everyone else.
Right.
I did.
Well, I'm proud of you, and I'd love to introduce your police chief to ours here. I've taken up a dialogue with the chief here in our town of Columbia, too, and he's a good man, and I'd love to introduce him or something.
I think that would be a great idea because what we find, really, just like with the gentlemen and people we met over at Barking Sands, is that whatever one thinks or says about, like, the office or the edifice, the key thing is to really look for the people with the heart. And resolve to, work with them and collaborate in different novel ways. Community to the people and working out like that. It's really important.
Everybody wants a nice, safe, secure, comfortable place to live and everything. And, I mean, everybody does, including the police,
Especially them.
Yeah.
Even though they would have less work to do in a way, but that would be fine. They could do other things. Just like Jim Channon proposed with the 1st Earth Battalion in the early 80s, at least, when I first met him. He's got this Arcturus group, and you can see the link on Planet Puna.
Mm-hmm.
But part of his vision with the Delta Force was to envision alternate roles for these various, again, edifices. What could they do instead? And how could they be in service instead? So we could find other things for our police to do than tasering three people to death in one week in Canada. I mean, there must be something else they can do, like get along, too. I mean, where's the strain going on with the police that they have to respond so vehemently?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, of course, I understand that they're in dangerous situations at times, so I appreciate their side of it.
They have a challenging job, but at the same time, they have to be compassionate people
maybe
as well.
A little bit sometimes.
But
ultimately, just like with Gentle Breath, the whole thing of domestic harmony is that we're proactive and we're solution-based, if you will, and easier to create generations of happy people and people who know how to live in harmony than to deal with all the repercussions culturally and socially and globally that we're contending with today.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what our celebrations are about. That's what our students are raving for, domestic harmony at the university on Thursday, with the political science cup behind us, and It's like, let's have a new attitude. Let's have a new thought about it. Just say yes to domestic harmony.
Right. Well, it, obviously you're making progress, and I'm proud of you. And I remember when we talked about it first, it wasn't that long, maybe a year ago, maybe a year and a half, and you've really done exactly what you said you were going to do, and it's awesome. So good job.
Now we've reached out profoundly. Yeah, I'm really proud of it.
All right.
I'm proud of the people for saying yes to
when it makes sense, you know? When it makes sense, it makes sense. And
plus, it fulfills Elizabeth Rauscher's dream, too, to have harmony in the world. So this is like a continuation of her life's dream as well. We're really happy to pick up.
Now, you've got a project with Elizabeth, maybe not particularly, I mean, I'm not sure how far along you are with it, but the Blonde Physics book.
Oh, well, actually, that's my project, and I've invited Elizabeth to collaborate with me in whatever way she can, but it's the Book of Blonde Physics. Written by a true blonde, which is different than just a natural blonde. And, you know, it takes different some things about blonde. But also, I like to call myself an experiential physicist, and that I feel physics. I feel like what it's like for soliton and singularity and, you know, local field effects and funny kinds of physics words. But I actually know what that feels like and how that works in experiencing life. So the Book of Blonde Physics addresses those things so that we understand physics in a way that makes sense to us. That it's like, oh, right. So one of one of my chapter titles is, how do you defy gravity, right? So the answer is just say boo. I know it's kind of silly, but in some ways the Book of Blonde Physics is really about taking things that we take for granted and like we made them edifices and laws and like heavy structures, like, you know, and like the speed limit of light.
Right.
Of course, it's obvious that light is everywhere instead. So once you change the concept of the limit of light, then all of the possibilities exist. Same thing with saying boo to gravity and defying it, you know. Mm-hmm. What else could there be beyond gravity?
I think that it's actually pretty, it's cool, because when I think about particle physics and, you know, electron spin resonance and angular momentum. And I think, you know, what does this really, how does this really affect people on a daily basis in their lives? Most people are pretty unconcerned with angular momentum, you know, and this sort of thing. So I agree that it's important to talk about what it means in the physical life and how it affects our day-to-day, you know, going about.
Yeah, well, thank you. Maybe since we'll have this on record, I could use that quote for the dust jacket for my book, Michael.
Well, we'll come up with something for it, I'm sure.
All right.
That was really nicely put, though.
So Michael, now Michael's on the other side of it, right? He's all about electron spin resonance right now and the origin of this sort of thing. Michael, when the origin of spin, I know, is something that Nassim and Elizabeth are very interested in, and along with that, if this is ever solved, comes energy applications that are profoundly different than the ones that we're used to. Is that right?
Yes. We should be able to engineer the vacuum. We can change and have various spins going on that we can create. And those promise things like, or possible effects like gravity control.
Hmm.
And, you know, at the moment it's all very theoretical.
Right.
We're working on it. But the basic idea is that the standard model very briefly says that all the angular momentum, all the spin, all the energy came from the Big Bang. In order to keep such a system running for billions of years, you have to assume that it has zero friction and that all the spin that we see just came from that one event.
Hmm.
Well, the trouble with that is that it only accounts for about 4% of the universe, and it fails on major problems like, where does the energy of an electron come from?
Mm-hmm.
Or where does the energy come from that holds a magnet to a refrigerator?
Right, and how do those things keep moving?
Yeah, and Nassim's basic answer is that things spin. And when they spin, they also contract, basically.
Mm.
And they'll contract until they approximate something like a singularity. And when they do that, they'll be spinning like mad. So, for example, an electron spinning near the speed of light. And so The idea is that the torque that creates the spin is an inherent property of space-time. That when you spin something, you're actually creating a denser field mm-hmm. and torque and more spin, that kind of thing.
Wow.
And anyway, when that works out, we think it'll solve problems like the 96% missing mass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole dark matter business.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll pick up on some of that with Elizabeth for sure in a little bit. Now, I have a technical issue that I have to deal with. Star, I'm going to have to call Elizabeth in about 5 minutes. So why don't you and I and Michael talk for a little bit more, but I'd like you to be able to sort of take the microphone right now and talk about anything that you'd like for the next few minutes.
Okay. Well, there goes our nightly transit system right through the heart of town. Well, right now, what we're preparing for, I mean, this is seriously live on the street. Okay, hold on. Because inside the Shaka's nightclub, it's louder. Okay, so tonight I met a very dear friend again named Sophie Boyer from France, who's come over to work with us and prepare our film project for Thalassa Productions,
mm-hmm.
a very, 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 very big French production house.
Mm-hmm.
And they would like to film our work along with others in the area, but they want to film our work about Dolphin Attended Birth
awesome.
And the Pod Project.
Yeah.
We're doing that, and Sophie is right here. She could just say aloha in her beautiful, charming French accent.
Please.
That would be wonderful. Here.
Sure.
Please. Here's La Belle Sophie. Aloha.
Aloha,
Sophie.
How are
you doing?
Very well.
How are you doing? Yes, I'm fine. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, and I'm so glad that you're working with Star. She does wonderful things, and I love her.
Yes, I do too.
All right, well, you all enjoy yourselves tonight, okay?
Thanks a lot. You too. Take care.
Aloha.
So, we're getting ready to be filmed in January. I'm working, and we're working with Papa K. Capolino,
mm-hmm.
who is a master Lomi Lomi practitioner. He's also likely the sole traditional dolphin birthing practitioner left. And so he's working with the expectant ladies that we're working with to help them meet the dolphins and prepare to give birth with them. This will be like quite an accomplishment because, you know, we've been working on it for some time.
Huh.
So there's that happening. And the Pod Home Project is picking up steam with, you know, more people coming on board with the idea of living on pod and what does that mean and promoting more domestic harmony through that. And, oh, yeah, we just started a group called Musicians for Domestic Harmony. You know, like how they have that group of musicians and performing artists against domestic drunk driving.
Yeah.
We just started with Ernie Cruz and his son John Cruz. Go Google those two guys, father and son. And it's Musicians for Domestic Harmony, and they're going to take a pledge, and they'll all get their green ribbons and bumper stickers and proclamations and all this. And and then they're going to spread the word about domestic harmony so we can have domestic harmony erupting across the face of the earth. Haley said we could do that. And the Navy loves it. That's, like, pretty amazing. That really has us very excited.
All right.
We're working on all of our projects and moving things right along.
Well, it's wonderful, and I think we'll have to find a date in January, maybe 1, 2, 3, if it's still...
I was just talking about that today, because we're working with Sophie to hook up our production, like we want to go out on a boat on the ocean, just like we did with Penn and Teller on 11/11.
Uh-huh.
We had the opportunity to go out with them on Domestic Harmony Awareness Day. And be in the water at 11/11 with the dolphins around and stuff. So
cool.
We want to go out and be in the water on 1, 2, 3, jump.
Well, I think
and then do your show in the afternoon or evening. That would be fabulous.
I think that the 21st is a Monday, so we'll probably have to deal with that. But we'll go from the 21st to the 22nd, then you can do something special on the 23rd.
Okay,
well, I'm going to have to say goodbye to you, and then me and Michael are going to take a break here. I'll put on a piece of music, and I'm going to get Elizabeth on the line, okay?
All right, and give my love to Elizabeth, or Kapeka, as she's known in Hawaiian, okay?
We'll do
love
it.
Love to you through Mike's and your audience, and Janelle. Love to Janelle. Aloha.
Aloha, Star. Thank you so much for everything.
Aloha.
If you'd like to contact Star Newland, you can do that on the web at planetpuna.com. Now, Michael, you hang in there, okay?
Okay.
And I'll put on a piece of music here, and then we will come back with Elizabeth, all right? All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And we're going to hear a song here from, it's John Condren and The Benefit. And this is a song called, this is appropriate, I think this one's called The Brain Trust. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
That's right, this is Mike Hagan. You are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Our guest for the rest of the evening is Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. She's a nuclear physics and engineering PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. Dr. Rauscher was a nuclear scientist and a researcher at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories. She's worked at Stanford Research Institute. She was a professor of physics at John F. Kennedy University in California. She's been a consultant to NASA, an advisor to the U.S. Navy, to the U.S. Congress. She's been a delegate and advisor to the United Nations. She's a brilliant woman. She can talk about astronomy, astrophysics, electromagnetism, quantum theory, consciousness, alternative energy, even psychic phenomenon. She's the author of hundreds of scientific papers, 4 books. She holds 4 patents. And she's currently on staff at the Resonance Project, and she's seeking a grand unification theory. And we're going to talk with her about as much of this as we can, starting right now, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. What a pleasure. Thank you, and welcome to Radio Orbit.
Well, it's glad to be on Radio Orbit, and I'm glad to talk to you, Mike. And there's a lot of fascinating stuff going on in this universe.
You know, I tried to cut down your bio as much as I could, and it's like I could have spent 2 hours probably doing that. But before I pat you on the back too hard, I want to say hello to Michael Heisen again, who's with us as well, another brilliant person and one of my friends and someone who I'm fortunate enough to have introduced me to the likes of you. So for both of you, thanks a whole lot. And Michael, Elizabeth, you guys can say hi.
Hi, Michael. Aloha.
Aloha.
So, Michael, while we still have you, I'd like you and Elizabeth just to, I don't know, rap a little bit about what you guys are up to at the Resonance Project. Anything you'd like to share with us, maybe, I don't know, just whatever you guys would like to talk about.
Well, first of all, the Resonance Project is an amazing place on the Kona Coast, and I think many of us there love to go swim with the dolphins, as long as they love to swim with us, and they seem to like to do that. But there's several main thrusts to the project there. One is to really understand and ken the universe and to look at the unification of the 4 force fields in a fundamental way, particularly through a conceptual idea that occurred for many years as a solution to Einstein's field equation, that is the black hole solution of Schwarzschild, and looking at that in more detail and recent cosmological information as galactic center black holes, stellar black holes, supernova, and so forth. And there's another dimension to the project there that's much more maybe down to earth, as you would say, and that's to work on energy systems. And everybody in the project is very environmentally oriented on the ideas that we need to substantially change our way of thinking to survive, as Albert Einstein said, and to develop energy systems, new ways of looking at resources, even to the point of planting rapidly growing trees to try to replenish depleted forestation and produce oxygen and absorb CO2. And many of us are very interested and connected to the idea that we're really part of this web of nature and that we can communicate with all kinds of species of plants and animals, and that we really are one with the cosmos and the earth. So I think those are central ideas that Michael and I share, and many of the people at the Resonance Project share.
It is quite an amazing place. The number of people that come through here and the things they know, from everything from permaculture to physics and dancing, and we just had dinner with a magician. It's just an amazing circus in a way.
All right. Well, everyone, you're listening to KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We're speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher and Dr. Michael Heisen. They're both involved with a project that's called the Resonance Project. Nassim Haramein is another physicist that's involved there. Elizabeth, I've spoken with Nassim on the air, and he's another just brilliant person. He certainly has a knowledge of, you know, orthodox physics, but he has an intuitive natural side of him, too, that's very, very interesting.
Well, I would have to say any physicist that really contributes to a new paradigm or a paradigm shift, the true practice of science and physics is the combination of knowledge and intuition. Without intuition or inspiration, there isn't a creation of a new reality, but it has to be grounded in the process of scientific exploration, as well as really making a bridge to the more established domains of physics. And building that bridge is sometimes rather difficult. There was a joke on TV that I really liked. It said, well, there needs to be a lot of construction in Iraq. Why don't we ship over a bunch of beavers? We can put up a dam in a night. I think that to bridge the gap between really a new way of looking at some of the aspects of nature and reality and the conventional view is going to take more than a team of beavers. I think it's going to take more like a team of people at the Resonance Project. More amazing people.
Well, you have certainly a component of the physical science people that are more like a priesthood, and they're not really interested in building the bridge in some cases, at least I've learned.
Well, that is definitely true. They have their territories and their domains, and it's very interesting to see the dynamics. When I was a grad student just beginning at UC Berkeley, I had the vision that science operated by complete rationality, knowledge, inspiration, and rationality.
I didn't know
that it also had an element of cockfighting.
Yeah, a big one.
And it was so funny to see two very respected professors that I was taking courses from and very highly respected after a lecture bickering over what I considered an issue that could not be resolved by a single conversation. That was between field theory and S-matrix theory. And I think I had a rather large disillusionment as to how ideas were put forward. That is, there is certainly the human component and the human interaction.
Well, it's obvious that you didn't let it stop you. So.
Well, I decided, and it is true, I had grad students in physics that were very disillusioned by some aspects of, as I said in one lecture I gave at Berkeley, about the dogmatism, the simsalabim, so to speak, of some of science. But I didn't give up, but I had to remind myself of what I thought. But two of my very good grad students gave up. They said they could not handle that. I respected their decision because it's their life. But I said, please hang in there. I need you.
Right.
But that's often the way of many institutions. It isn't just the scientific institution.
I agree.
Fossil fuel. It's the investment in money and power and different political views. So it's part of human nature that we need to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of like old habits die hard. It's pretty simple in a way.
Yes, it is. And if you don't develop new habits, you don't have any fun and adventure.
That's for sure. I am all about that. Well, speaking of fun and adventure, Dr. Heisen, what do you have to share with us maybe before we say goodbye to you?
Oh, well, besides the great delight of having Elizabeth connected with you, that's really great. I've just been having such a delightful time with Elizabeth, and I wish her great success in all her work. And I guess the most exciting thing we got to at the end of the day, she may appreciate this, is we looked at the torque term and realized that if we use the Lagios satellites, we can figure out the shear modulus for space-time. How about that one, Elizabeth?
I think that's very true. In other words, the Michelson-Morley experiment in the 1887 that was looking for the ether drift of the Earth going through the ether that sustained the electromagnetic waves in a new way of looking at what's called frame dragging, I think is a new way of looking at a new neo-ether. And what Michael adds to that, I think, is very, very important. And I think that there's a whole new set of experiments. Some are being conducted with satellites, and there's more to do to find out that there may be a universal plenum throughout the universe. And this is one of the interests of the Resonant Project.
Amazing. Well, Michael, I think it's amazing that you and Elizabeth and Nassim, and I'm sure there are other wonderful people that are all working there together, and I imagine that wonderful things are going to come out of there, and I'm hoping that it's too sweet.
All right.
Right.
Yes, us too. I'll let Elizabeth have the rest of the show, of course, and great luck to you. Love you both.
Thank you so much, Michael, and we'll get back on the air on the 21st of January, and we'll talk for a full program, okay?
Excellent.
It's good to talk
Aloha.
To Michael.
Aloha, Michael.
Aloha.
All right. Wonderful stuff. He's an amazing guy. You know, he's from my hometown, Dr. Asher.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But I am absolutely impressed with many of the people in various capacities that have shown up at the Resonant Project. Hmm. I'm really impressed and amazed with many of the people, the computer engineering, the engineering staff, the support staff, the scientific staff, been a wonderful group to interact with, open-minded and rigorous.
Well, it's actually very encouraging because obviously there's a facility, and I'm assuming that people are getting compensated in some way, shape, or form for the work that they're doing. And that means that the funding is at least to a certain extent there. And I think that must be at least sort of good news.
Well, I think Nassim has done an excellent job of putting the project together and getting the funding in place with several of his acquaintances and friends. And I appreciate that greatly. I appreciate the opportunity. And it's quite a fascinating adventure in really kind of almost carving out and structuring a new way of working together on technical problems. It's quite fascinating.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll talk a little bit more, I'm sure a lot more about that as we go through the program, but I'd like to sort of backtrack a little bit and talk a little bit about your background before we go too much further. There are a lot of people that are interested in what people have done before they're doing what they're doing, and you have a very interesting background. And I thought maybe you could just share a little bit about where you come from. I know we mentioned earlier that you got your PhD at Berkeley, but you've worked at some interesting places and come across some very interesting people. Maybe you could just share a little bit of that with us.
Well, when I started working for NASA, I thought, I'm always fascinated. I'm one of those kids that drew pictures of rockets and listened to Star Trek. And
me too.
Even listened to Flash Gordon, which was pretty crummy. Much else. But The Outer Limits and science fiction theater and all kinds of stuff. And they asked me whether I'd go into space, and I said, yes, haven't got there yet, at least in a physical vehicle. But when I was a child, I lived in nature, in the woods. And I.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Northern California in the uh-huh. Redwoods.
Wow.
And I had plenty of lizards, snakes, and spiders to study. And
mm-hmm.
Sometimes would see a deer, and I saw a couple of mountain lions, and I decided I'd say about four to study nature. I didn't know what a scientist was in a full definition, but I really was interested in nature. And I remember walking around. Of course, the stars were so visible because we were way out away from... Our nearest neighbor was approximately a 25-minute horse ride. So
wow.
That was one of the mode of transportation. And then I met an astronomer when I was eight. And he started talking about, like, Carl Sagan with all these billions and billions, and it just fascinated me. So I thought I'd go into astronomy, and then I decided I really want to study consciousness. So I'll study the very small and the atom, and the very large, which is the cosmos, and see if I can extrapolate the consciousness somewhere in the middle. And I concluded that probably consciousness is the driving force of everything. And then I also studied nuclear physics with the idea, I even wrote my first paper when I was a junior in high school that got published when I was an undergraduate on Berkeley on fusion reactors. My thought was there would be wars over oil and that we needed to look for other directions in fossil fuel. So I've always been interested in alternative energies.
That turned to be spot on, huh?
I was right on that one. However, I didn't realize the water pollution would be so bad, so
yeah,
I didn't guess that one correctly. I hit one and missed another. But it's amazing. I felt like in the 60s there was an opportunity to change our way of thinking. It's taken longer, and I just hope the actions are going to be soon enough. To really, you see, I felt like the thing, there's such a basis of need of energy for people to have water, to pump water in the developing countries, to be able to grow foodstuffs and support themselves and to prevent starvation. So I see this as not just a convenience of civilized countries having SUVs and refrigerators, but a need as a global idea and in physical form to alleviate suffering and to benefit people. And that's what I felt from the beginning, and that I joined the Sierra Club when I was 12, and I felt that it was very important that the energy forms. And that's why, at first I was interested in the fission reactors, and I got a master's in nuclear engineering, but I felt like if the nuclear waste wasn't handled properly, which I felt from high school, if there wasn't a solution to that problem, the nuclear industry was not going to be the way to go, particularly because of the fact that you're not going to only need energy sources that are relatively clean, but you're going to need an economically feasible system. And particularly in third world nations, it's got to be relatively fixable and simple in order for people to be able to repair and utilize it, like probably solar collectors and wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the solar thing, ever since I've been a kid, I've just been staring up at the sun. And I'm just a huge sun bug. I'm very interested in solar phenomenon.
Oh, I love it. I tell you, I felt in the geophysical, this will give my age away to the listeners, but in 57, which I was pretty young, but I do remember the geophysical year, and of course I sat out on my roof looking for Sputnik. With a telescope, I found binoculars work better. And then once you learn to see it, you could see it with the naked eye.
Right. You just got to know what to look for, yeah.
You got to know what to look for. Uh-huh. I remember after I got so, my gosh, I'd lay out in a hillside and see four or five satellites in 20 minutes later, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing how much is actually flying around up there if you take some time and look.
Oh, it's incredible.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of action up there these days, and a lot of it isn't planes.
It is a lot of it isn't planes, and of course that bridge goes over into the life questions that we are asking, and some of them do have to do with this recent resurgence of the UFO issue.
Oh, what a strange story! Yeah, well, I'd like to talk with you about that maybe a little bit later, and your interpretation of that perhaps. But before we do that, let me ask you a question about. Well, I've had a number of people that have sent me emails and have contacted me before the program and know that you worked at SRI. And that's a place that is sort of infamous and famous at the same time and has a lot of well, you know, it has some good, bad, and ugly stories that are thrown around about it. But certain people that you were involved with there, that maybe you could talk about your experience. One of the persons that I was very interested in was Andre Puharich.
Oh, what a character! What a story! He was an amazing guy. Russell Targ, Hal Puthoff, and Andrea Puharich, and Andrea had brought Uri Geller over from Israel in the beginning when the project at SRI began.
And this was parapsychological work, right?
Yes, it was funded through the Navy, and it was called, I think the original one was called Project Grill Flame, but that's in the public domain now.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was how reliable and reproducible is remote perception, which is really a combination of the old-fashioned words like clairvoyance,
mm-hmm.
telepathy, clairaudience, and so forth.
Right.
But the remote viewing kind of is a better terminology. It doesn't have as much stigma, and it covers a wider range of concepts, whether there's mind-to-mind communication or whether we can see distant spaces with accuracy. And the answer is, I was a skeptic. However, I had had some unusual childhood experiences that left me open to consider the possibility. But when I tried what was called the four-choice trainer, which was a random number generator that you would guess what the next number was,
right.
I was perfectly at chance.
Hmm.
But after I started doing the remote viewing experiments and I was outbound and people read my mind, described what I did and where I was in great detail, and then later I could do it myself, I did go through about 3 days of thinking about that, because, of course, the inclination is to go to the head of Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory where I was working and say, hey, you know, this stuff is true. But, you know, you get laughed out of the office and totally not believed.
Right, right.
No matter what you said or did.
Right, and even if you have evidence sometimes.
Even if I had evidence, and we did a lot of psychokinetic experiments, mind over matter, where we had materials that were... I had analyzed with electron microscopes and saw differences. I had multiple labs throughout the United States look at the materials that were bent paranormally and those that were bent by crystallographers.
Mm-hmm.
And they all agreed that the mind-bent devices and materials, which were laboratory-grown crystals in some cases, and some that had never been touched, but they were influenced by people remotely,
mm-hmm.
were uniquely different. But it's such a different way of thinking that the power of the mind is so great. And I was writing some notes earlier tonight. You know, it's amazing. It's amazing. Some of the principles I think upon which nature operates is love and admiration.
Mm-hmm.
And if you live out in the woods alone, which I used to do, I used to go camping alone in my 20s and early 30s, and animals behave quite differently when you're not with a group of people.
Yeah.
And you don't think of yourself as a person.
Mm-hmm.
If you just think of yourself as being, then they may, I mean, all kinds of animals, including bears and so forth, come up and sniff me and try to figure out what I am.
Right.
And so I've had quite a few interesting experiences along that line. And so part of what needs to happen is we've got everybody growing up in cities. They're cut off from their natural environment. And we need to get back to that unity of nature and the concept of being in nature.
Mm.
And that is the support system that, you know, comprises philosophy, religion, and science, and all those endeavors together.
You know, you mentioned this idea of being in the woods, and you're a person that's very familiar with nature. When you mentioned the talk about remote viewing and trying to see into spaces that are, you know, not generally accessible in this, are you familiar with shamanism, with the techniques of shamanism?
Yes, to some degrees, yes. I have met some Aboriginal and Native American shamans. Mm. And
because essentially a legitimate shaman can you know, do that sort of thing.
Definitely. To add to the SRI part of it, I think the communication is not only between knowledge of distant places and what different distant people are thinking, but it's part of the communication with animals and plants.
Mm, right, right, right.
And I always had this dream for about 15 years off and on of living with the Hopi and Navajo people.
Mm.
And through a nice set of coincidences, which might be called Jungian synchronicities, I ended up staying with the Hopi people in Hope Villa. And so much of their life is based on telepathic information that, to explain remote viewing, didn't seem like other. It didn't.
Mm.
It was not outside the, or it was like explaining a water to a fish. You know, it's so accepted that
right.
It isn't other. But so much of what goes on in this, in the shamanistic practices, and I was sleeping on a dirt floor and a spider had crawled in my mouth and bit my cheek.
Ouch.
And I had a large swelling on my face, and so one of the elders used sacred tobacco and rubbed it in the inside of my mouth, and in about 3.5 hours, or about 4 hours, swelling was completely gone, no pain.
Mm-hmm.
No pain, just like that. I mean, if you went to a doctor, he'd probably give you a bunch of shots.
Oh, yeah.
It would take days to heal. But I've seen a lot of interesting stuff, and some of the practices are really kind of like a test, like the fire walk. It's really a test of learning to be in an altered state.
Right, right.
And overcome the boundaries of ordinary thinking. And we had a huge fire when I was about 8 years old that nearly burned down our property.
Huh.
And it burned over about 25,000 acres, about 20,000 acres. And so even at 8, I was helping ride the fire line to see whether it had crossed roads and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So they had employed the army and kids. And so I went to do the fire walk, and I had decided absolutely not to do it because I wasn't going to, you know, I mean, my God, you know, those hot coals.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, do you know who Joseph Chilton Pierce is?
No.
Well, he's a man and a writer and a very interesting person who's written a lot about altered states of consciousness and a state that he calls unconflicted thought. But at any rate, he wrote a book years ago called A Crack in the Cosmic Egg.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes. Well, anyway, what happened is it was trying to think of his name. He's the one that does the orange juice ad. Tony Robbins.
Oh, Tony Robbins, sure.
Yeah, so I'm sitting there thinking, man, I'm not going to do this.
Yeah.
Well, of course, after 3 hours, I did it. And
uh-huh.
What was interesting is someone videotaped me, and there were flames about 6 inches high. So it wasn't just hot coals,
uh-huh.
but there were flames.
Right, right, right.
And he says to say, cool moss.
Huh.
And it was at night. And the grass was cool because it was wet.
Mm-hmm.
So when you started walking barefoot on the grass and went to walk on the coals and the flames, it felt the same. It felt like cool moss.
Amazing.
And you can see from the photos that I'm in a very deep trance. So I got to the end and then sort of came out of the trance, and a coal had caught between my big toe and the next toe. You know, and so as I came out of the trance, I felt the heat from that.
Sure.
And so I shook it off, and then when I got back to my room, there was a blister sitting there, and I said, my gosh, if I did the fire walk and felt nothing, what's that blister
That's
doing
right.
there?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It went away.
Isn't that amazing?
And it is. Well, it is a very profound lesson, and some people who have done it more than once got over confidence, and some of them ended up in the hospital with burnt feet.
Yeah, you know, this guy, Joseph Pierce, that I was mentioning, the only reason I bring him up is because he tells a story, a similar story, where I think it was in Fiji where he walked, and he made a comment on the program one time when I interviewed him. He said, you know, for the people who don't think that this is the real deal, he said, if you go there and actually do it, he said, you'll find that every year there's a certain number of people that are badly injured and sometimes actually even die in the pits. And,
I know.
And he said, I call that the control group.
Well, I'll tell you. Well, it does eliminate the competition. I guess everybody has to become a shaman. In a sense, what that truly says is everybody has that potential.
Right.
But I absolutely felt no sensation. Absolutely no heat. We put the mysteries and systems on people's feet to measure temperature, and some of it went up to as much as 2,500 to 3,000 degrees in some cases, as I recall.
Mm-hmm,
in other words,
mm-hmm.
It was way outside what you get in an oven.
Right.
And
right.
If you ask me exactly how does it work, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but it's certainly not latent frost or perspiration, because that would soon disappear. But yeah, I've heard of people where, like, by the time they do the third one, the too overconfident and cocky, and it is a lesson in the balance between belief and assuredness and not ego.
Because
when you get the ego, oh, heck, I can do this.
Oh, yeah.
I did it before. Those are the ones that end up in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Boy, Fiji, yeah, I imagine that they probably have bigger flames.
Yeah, it's a pretty serious thing, and you better be darn well prepared, like you say, and it's not for someone who's unprepared, because you will really, you can very well hurt yourself. So, all right, last question before, we'll take a break at the bottom of the hour here, but I want to put the Andre Puharich and the Hal Pudoff and all the CIA business to sleep, at least to ask you about it. A lot of people have had concern over the years about CIA sponsorship and mind control and that sort of stuff. How concerned should people be about that stuff? Or do you even...
Well, there's a huge history of this, and some of it's come out on the Discovery Channel and some of the other programs that have to do with, of course, in the beginning, they were trying to use LSD as something you could put in water and control people's minds.
And even psilocybin. I know Puharich was involved in the mushroom.
And a number of other things. And the point is, it actually is very ineffective. In general, the remote viewing involves a pretty standard concentrated state. In other words, paying attention. As a viewer, you need to pay attention and clear your mind of extraneous thoughts. And as an outbound experimenter, you need to not be worrying about your ex-husband in Hawaii, as one person did, and then the person drew hula girls and trees instead of the site. So it's so incredibly accurate that sometimes you have to do months of research to find out about the details of various structures. However, it isn't always correct. In other words, there's signal and noise, and even some of the noise is other psychic input, and recognizing what is the input that's being requested. It's like a least action principle of finding that information that is what is being requested. And the CIA had several different programs, and one of them, the later one, was to try to teach people to do remote viewing, not just see how well they could do.
Right.
And it didn't seem to matter whether the person was skeptical as long as they were open-minded to try it at that time. But how much psychic spying is there and so forth, I can't, first of all, I can't really answer the question, but I would say it's probably not with all the satellite stuff and infrared and RF and all those other techniques, a dominant method of
intelligence gathering,
spying.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that's my guess.
Okay. All right. Well, fair enough. I tell you what, that's a good place to let us take a little break, okay?
Okay.
All right, let's do that. We'll come back, and we will talk some more. We got plenty of time and lots of good questions that are popping up here in the chat room, and I've got a few of my own. So I hope you're all enjoying it. We'll come back with Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher in just a few minutes. Okay, Liz?
Fine.
All right, thanks. Everybody, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And like I say, you are listening to Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. It's a pleasure and a privilege to have her on the air with us. We'll be able to talk with her for the next hour and a half. And get your questions and comments coming. I've got a number of them already, and I'd be glad to try to get to them if I can, all right? Okay, in the meanwhile, this is a song by John Condren and The Benefit. It is called Another Graduation. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia.
Thank you.
John Condren and the Benefit. That's called Another Graduation from a disc that was released in 2004 called, oh yeah, Down to Dorsey. Anyway, great stuff. John Condren and the Benefit. And we'll hear a few more from them before the end of the program, okay? All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 12:35 a.m. now on the 27th of November, 2007. Can you believe it? The time just rolling right on by. And by the way, speaking of good music, it is the anniversary of Jimi Hendrix's birthday, actually. Hendrix was born on the 27th of November in 1942. Can you believe it? Jimi Hendrix would have been 65 years old today. And I think he died when he was 27, back around 1969 or 1970. So anyway, Jimmy, my brother, thanks for all the great stuff that you did for us. And I'm sure there's a little bit of influence there with John Condon as you hear that music tonight. So anyway, back to Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. Dr. Rauscher, thank you so much for sticking around with us.
Enjoying it. I was going to mention there's a nice website of Russell Targ's on his research on ESP, and it's called ESPResearch.com.
All right, ESPResearch.com. That's Russell Targ. And I should give out, of course, your website right now is ElizabethAnnRauscher.com. Elizabeth with a Z, ElizabethAnnRauscher.com. And you can link there directly from my site over at MikeHagan.com. And you can also find information about Elizabeth and the work that she's involved in, or at least some of the work that she's involved with, over at The Resonance Project. That's theresonanceproject.org. So, okay. All right. A question about just sort of general theories of physics. A number of people ask, does Dr. Rauscher think string theory holds any water, and is that the direction that we should be looking? And I guess a related question is string theory part of the work that's or the theory that's being used there at the Resonance Project?
Well, I've actually been looking at string theory in recent years. When I was at Berkeley Lab, Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, there was what was called the Venziano model, which was a predecessor of the string theory. And one of the ideas is, in a simple view, is to consider every particle a point particle, but you can't really solve the equations for a point particle because the differential equations go to infinity. So the idea is to consider them as open and closed vibrating strings, which occupy a small but a significant domain. And there's been a lot of criticism of the string theory. The thing is, there are very few analytical equations in which they are predictive and they have a specific solution, like F equals ma and Newton's universal law of gravitation. In other words, although the equation isn't universal to quantum phenomena or relativistic phenomena, where it does apply, it is analytic and does give correct solutions to what is called the two-body problem. That is the interaction, say, of two planets.
Mm.
Like the equation F equals G, which is the gravitational constant, the mass of one of the systems times the mass of the other divided by R squared. And there's similar laws in electromagnetics that are relatively simple, and they will predict what the force is between the two bodies. And another one is the rate of falling rocks that when Galileo was dropping them off the Leaning Tower of Pisa, you know, a big one and a little one fall at the same rate because it's independent of the mass.
Right, right.
But it accelerates as the distance is proportional to the time squared, and so it accelerates, and gravitational forces are accelerative.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But in many areas of physics, we're dealing with a whole bunch of different bodies or particles, like anytime you have a piece of matter, even if it's a nanotubule or some small section of matter, you still have a number of particles interacting. So there's certain approximations that you have to make and certain what are called free parameters. So you'd have to say, if I'm going to construct a fundamental physics theory, it should be analytic. That is, it should have one equation and one solution.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of physics is done by approximation and putting in free parameters. And the criticism of the string theory is that there's no direction that tells you the exact string theory that works. However, there's an interesting thing in the 1960s with one of the basic components to string theory, which is the SU3 group, the super unitary group, which is what's called the Lie group. It does show that there were octets and decuplets of particles, and they predicted what was called the omega minus particle, and the experiments found that particle, so it was predictive. And it is part of the subset of string theory, which is a much more elaborate group theory. And the criticism against it, as I say, is that it's not a simple law that just says that there's one equation with one particular solution or one particular prediction, that there are some parameters that you have to put in to calculate certain things you're trying to find out. And I facetiously call it the theory crank. If you put in known experimental values into a theory, and then you turn the theory crank and you get other numbers out that aren't too wrong, then you can say you do know something. However, that something may not be an absolute fundamental reality, mm-hmm. but a description of nature that's useful, but right. maybe not completely fundamental.
There was this German philosopher that comes to mind. His name was Wittgenstein, and he used to talk about something being true enough. He would say, you know, there are certain things that are true enough. They may not be particularly true in all cases everywhere in the universe, but in this particular corner, in the way that we're observing things, they're true enough.
Well, a good example of that, if you're going to pick out a watermelon, and people go thump the watermelon, and there's sort of a nice kind of hollow sound that has to do with the fact that there's more liquid or more juice, and usually it implies that the watermelon's riper and sweeter. That correlation doesn't always hold, so it's not universal, but there's a tendency for it to be true.
Right.
So it's sort of true enough for picking watermelons, and it's true enough for maybe picking, hopefully, genetically non-engineered tomatoes.
Right.
And if they're too firm and they feel like a baseball, I would definitely think I would not want to eat it.
All right. You mentioned the two-body problem. I have a question that came up, and I think it's a reasonable time to ask it. A listener says, what does Elizabeth think of the binary star theory, in particular, in our solar system? You know, there are people now that say that precession is not particularly caused by the wobble of the Earth, but because of the effect of a sister star that we share in orbit with that we're not particularly familiar with.
Well, the binary stars, who are called, there are several different things that have helped us make a measurement scale of what we think we're observing with our instruments or telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
And radio, as well as infrared and ultraviolet, all the different spectrum that we look at,
okay.
as well as the optical. And Cepheid variables, which have a variation in their emitted light, and also binary stars, where two stars appear to be going around each other. And if you look very carefully over time in the films that are taken, you can see that there is a movement. And sometimes there are cases where a star appears to be orbiting something, And the something may be a black hole because you can't see the other member.
Right.
As far as one person asked me years ago on a radio program whether I thought the Bermuda Triangle was caused by a black hole. And I said no, because it would suck in the rest of the Earth. Or if it being a planet X or some mysterious other body that we haven't observed, I think that's very unlikely. And poor Pluto's now kind of lost its reputation as a planet.
Yeah, it's pretty rude.
I think it's very rude. I think it's nasty. But I actually believe that Phimos and Deimos, the two small moons of
Mars,
might have actually been a moon at one time that blew up. And the moon is very important to the stability of the Earth's rotation the sun and about its axis. Is part of the system. So actually, what's interesting is the sun, moon, Earth really comprise a very stable three-body system.
There's some really interesting geometry and numbers that are associated with those three relationships too.
It's a very interesting process. I thought I'd throw in something optimistic.
Please.
We had a very active, unusually long solar cycle. And what I find is that there actually is an influence on people. There's the heavy proton interaction with the upper ionosphere produces about a 9.38 to a 9.41 magnetic pulsation frequency, which is about the alpha power spectrum peaking of humans. And you can find detecting this frequency, it entrains brain waves to alpha.
Really?
And alpha frequency is kind of like the brain raster. It's sort of the state of relaxation. You can be alert and relaxed. And sometimes it produces more traffic problems because people want to remain in beta. They don't want to mellow out and listen to what's happening in the environment. But I think that every time we go through one of these big solar cycles, it's like surfing a wave. I think there's a very positive energy that is produced that allows us to really create a new way of thinking.
Well, this cycle that we're essentially in the middle of right now, if you believe the models, say that the 2011-2012 peak of the cycle is supposed to be significantly more intense than we've experienced over the last, quite some time.
Well, there is an interesting correlation between sunspot cycles and the mini ice age in the 1500s in Europe. Galileo had already started observing sunspots and, of course, seeing craters on the moon and got very in trouble with the establishment. And I thought to myself as a kid, is there still a lot of prejudice and is the days of getting in trouble with the establishment dead? And the answer is no. But he did. There was this solar minimum for about 150 years that led to a mini ice age. And lately, some of the cycles, there was a coronal ejection in 1972. It was so large that it knocked the Earth into being in a rotational rate of a second longer. And they had to correct all the atomic clocks. So lately we've been having more active solar cycles, and that also is associated with global warming. So I think it's going to be very interesting, and of course a lot of people are interested in the Mayan calendar and 2012, and whether just by their thinking about it, they might produce some sort of effect, but it may be kind of like Y2K, nothing will happen. So, but it's making people think about not just everyday existence and getting to their work and home and getting the kids fed, but that we need to take responsibility for our role on this planet. And I'm hoping that that will be part of this set of concepts.
Me too. You mentioned the fact that that the sun has a electromagnetic interaction with human beings. Maybe you could talk a little bit about bioelectromagnetism, something that you're interested in.
Well, my late husband, William Van Buys, who died 2.5 years ago, and I spent actually 24 years doing research together. We were married for 20 years. And actually, if you Google, you can find my name under Rauscher and Rauscher hyphen Bice, B-I-S-E. And then there's a lot of references to William Van Buys.
Mm-hmm.
So that has some of the work we did on E&M effects on biological systems. And at the time when I met Bill in 1979, we got married in the beginning of 84. But anyway, he was married at that time. And his wife said that his equipment, even though it wasn't turned on, his function generators and radio frequency detectors were giving her large nosebleeds and affecting her menstrual cycle. And, of course, he didn't believe that. So he did a series of experiments to prove her wrong, because he didn't believe that low-intensity, low-frequency fields would have any effect on biological systems, the standard engineering view.
Right.
And so he did a series of experiments with continuous wave RF, and he found significant brainwave changes that of people exposed to different fields from a remote probe. And then when I met him in 79, he had already done these experiments. They were published in Physiological Chemistry and Physics in 1978, and then another paper was published supporting his results. But when I met him in 79, I also was a complete skeptic and thought the likelihood of these low-intensity fields would have any biological consequence. So we both started out believing this was not true. And man, did I find I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. And it's highly frequency specific, waveform specific, and intensity specific. So if you have a power line that has a really good sine wave, not like a kind of a choppy triangle wave or irregular wave or a spike wave, it doesn't seem to have very much consequences. But unfortunately, the power grid, the way it's interconnected, and with the DC pi antenna of the million KV lines, the irregular waveforms do have biological consequences. And certain frequencies are very dangerous. What you could actually do is, if the right frequencies were allocated, you could either find benign frequencies or you could actually heal people with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I doubt that people are going to choose that. But I definitely know that you can highly affect. In fact, we did some experiments where we were generating some RF frequencies. You walk in front of the beam and you could find it about 35% of the energy was absorbed by your body. And some of them would cause you to be weirded out for several days afterwards.
Gosh, I remember the work of this guy in the early 1900s whose name was Royal Raymond Rife.
Oh, yeah.
Remember him?
Yeah,
and it reminds me of Tesla's work, too, in a certain way, and Wilhelm Reich and all these guys.
Yeah, and Bill studied a lot of them. What's interesting is Tesla had proposed that there were all the antennas we use now are called Hertzian antennas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
After Heinrich Hertz. Did a series of experiments in 1888 that showed that radio waves and visible rays were the same. They were part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Actually, a light wave, yeah.
Yeah, it's the same as a light wave, and that the magnetic and electric vectors propagated perpendicular to the direction of motion of that wave. Well, I have shown, theoretically at least, that you can develop an extended form, which is called an amended form of Maxwell's equation, in a book that was published of mine in 1983, but it's going to be republished this year or early next, that you can also have longitudinal components to B and E field, which is what Tesla suggested, mm-hmm. were non-Hertzian waves.
Mm.
And I believe the brain and some of the natural systems actually work as non-Hertzian antennas, and in order to detect these waves, you need to have a non-Hertzian emitter and receiver.
Mm. Amazing.
My first conversation with Bill was on my interpretation and his interpretation of the Colorado Springs experiment in a Wardenclyffe tower.
Yeah, when Tesla shut the whole place down.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, some of the stories are so funny.
Oh, man, I love it.
He invents a generator, everybody's got electricity, but then he uses it in his experiments at his lab and, of course, blows out the local generators, and everybody gets ticked.
Hey, let me ask you about the relationship to gravity. You know, up until now, electricity and magnetism sort of go together, but no one's been able to, at least in an established sense, bring gravity into the equation. I know that's probably a big part of what you're working on.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is, I would say this way. Something about the four forces that are thought to exist in nature.
Yeah, yeah, please.
There's the strong and weak interaction, which are short range and deal with nuclear processes. And there's been a theory called the electroweak theory that combines the weak interactions with the electromagnetic force. And then there was a series of papers by Kaluza and Klein in the 1930s, which interested Einstein, where electromagnetic phenomena was combined with gravitational phenomena. But there's still a big struggle to try to develop a quantum gravity theory or a way of identifying how gravity fits with electromagnetic strong and weak interactions. One reason is gravity is very long range, but it's weak compared to the other forces.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very nonlinear. And the fundamental component or idea of quantum mechanics is it's a linear system. It has linear superposition of what's called wave functions. And I just published a paper recently, I sent it in for publication, that shows that perhaps the way to combine gravity and quantum mechanics unify them in some fashion as a quantum gravity theory might be to expand the space of the quantum domain to include slightly nonlinear terms. And this is something I've been working on since the early 70s. I don't think I would say that there's really any fundamental quantum gravity theory that's accepted universally by physicists. But it's very interesting because, of course, Einstein's dream, and there's a book called Einstein's Dream, was to unify the four forces. And that has been a fundamental driving force or intention within the physics community for 60 years or more.
Hmm.
And of course there's many ways, and actually the string theory is one approach to this. Now whether it's going to succeed to the point of getting more universal acceptance or not, I don't know. I mean, there's a great deal of effort and work being done on it. And there's a nice book by Lisa Randall called Warp Passages that has some of the work on string theory. It was published, I think, about 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay. All right. Well, we are just at the top of the hour now. What is it, 11 o'clock, I guess, there in California for you?
It's actually heading on to 12.
12? Oh, I, you're right. You're only 1 hour behind me now, I guess.
Yeah.
And, well, we're going to take a little break here, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more, okay?
Okay.
All right, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. You can find information about her on the web at ElizabethAnnRauscher.com. You can link there directly from my site. From here on out, we'll have this program up in the archives sometime tomorrow afternoon as an MP3 that you can download and share with your friends. Podcast will be up as well. And certainly, you can take a look over at Elizabeth's website. She has a very interesting article, or I guess it's a written piece talking about consciousness and the new physics on her front page. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that particular idea when we come back. And in the meantime, we will play another piece of music here from John Condren and The Benefit. You can find me on the web at Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. Of course, KOPN on the web at KOPN.org. All right, it is Mike, and you are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. And like I say, this is a song from John Condren and The Benefit. And what are we going to hear here? I think this one is called Lullaby for Jill. All right, back in just a few minutes with Elizabeth Ann Rauscher. We'll be right back. All right, John Condren and the Benefit. Lullaby for Jill. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. A little bit of Tim Finn, Crowded House, sounds like a little bit to me. Who else do I hear there? Better Than Ezra, a little bit maybe. My friend on the web here says a little bit like the band Live. Certainly that last song, yeah. But anyway, good stuff from Chicago. John Condren and the Benefit on the web at johncondren.com. And you can link there again from my music archives, all right, over there at mikehagan.com. It is Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, and you can find information about her on the web at elizabethannrauscher.com and also at theresonanceproject.org. All right, Dr. Rauscher, hi. Thanks for staying around with us.
Hi, how are you doing?
Just wonderful, and I'm just having a great time talking with you tonight.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it, too.
Good. Thank you so much. All right, lots of things to talk about here, so let me ask you, this is a wonderful article that you have up on your website, and a number of people have asked questions about it, but there's one guy in particular whose name is Saul Paul Sirag.
Oh, yes, I know him well.
Would you talk about him a little bit and his ideas of how the world might work?
I met Saul Paul Sirag in the very early 70s, and I am extremely impressed with him. He is one of the best group theoretical physicists I ever met, and a lot of the current physics, like the superstring ideas, involve group theory. And I feel that he's developed a very comprehensive theory. He's published some papers. I don't know if he has a website, but he's writing a book, and I'm anxious to see it published because I really admire the work that he's done.
For those unfamiliar, what is group theory?
Group theory is like, suppose I had a group of yellow marbles, and they were elements of the group of marbles, but there was one blue one in there.
Mm-hmm.
The blue one is a marble, so it occupies the group of marbles, but it doesn't occupy the group of
yellow marbles.
Marbles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way of classifying particles, what particles appear to be similar to other particles in elementary particle physics. And it started out, actually, group theory was originally developed to describe what they call lattice groups or continuous groups to describe symmetry relationships in crystals, crystallography. And then it was extended to what are called the Lie algebras, which describe the groups in elementary particle physics. And the group theory of the continuous groups for crystallography and the Lie groups are also related to each other.
Well, as I read your article, there are a number of people that are mentioned, some that go back quite a ways, and I'm not even surprised anymore, but I'm always interested when I find out how much of this stuff is rooted in the past.
Oh, yes. You know, it's interesting to me that work that I did like 30 years ago, there were some papers I published particularly on collective states of electron phenomena in plasmas in 68, and that got a lot of attention when it was published,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
Other papers have been slow to be considered. So it's only recently some of the works on my hyperdimensional complex geometries are now getting some attention in the physics community. So it takes a while. Some things come on with a splash, and there are things that come on with a splash that turn out to not be based in enough support from other researchers.
Mm-hmm.
And but often it's I'll say that It's kind of interesting. I'll give an example between Edison and Tesla. Edison said invention was 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. And Tesla would actually mock his motors up in his mind and have such a complete visual imagery that he could even tell the points of wear of when he had to redesign his motors.
Mm.
And one time he was visualizing a generator, and there weren't many cars in those days, but he drove off the road into a grassy field. I was imagining a windmill design that I was working on, that would be small, compact, and economically feasible. But I didn't drive off the road when I was doing it. But I think it's a real synergistic relationship between the need for the inspiration. But what I find in science, there is a lot of work. I had a dream. Actually, I literally dreamed up a fundamental equation that's basic to my quantum gravity work in my books and papers. And I was photographing lichen in a cow field with some other people, and I went back to the hotel or motel, and I was sleeping, and I kind of sometimes will have a dream, a lucid dream, where I go into my underground lab, and so I was working on the problem, and this equation came to me, so I thought, oh my God, that's the answer. It's a term in Einstein's stress energy tensor in the field equation. So I was dreaming. I thought, oh, well, I'll plug in the numbers. I know what the universal constants are, the velocity of light and the gravitational constant. And those were the days of the HP calculators. And as I must have divided by zero, because a big red error bar came up in my dream and woke me up. And I said, I'm sure I made a mistake, but I wrote the equation down.
Uh-huh.
But it took me about 10 years to work out all the physics related to
it.
So
is that
inspiration
something else?
Can be nice and totally meaningful, but man, there's a lot of diligent work that is just very methodical, and some of it is kind of nitpicking, and it actually is, to me, a different state of consciousness than the visionary part of it. It's really paying attention to details, and I like both.
I think it
can be laborious to do all the nitpicking stuff, but they both appeal to me.
Well, I think it's fascinating because I also know that, you know, scientists, as a general rule, I think don't really recognize it maybe as much as they might. But many of the advancements that have come over the course of science over many, many millennia, actually, have come through strange inspiration, dreams or visitations from angels or who knows what. And it's interesting that the science is oftentimes inspired by the mystical, etherical realm.
Oh, I think so, too. And I feel that what one needs to integrate in their life is the mystical and the scientific, that is something that's very important to bring together in one's personal existence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think these need to be brought together in society. I think there's such a schism, really, in our current society between what is called religion or philosophy and science that really needs to be brought together to, I think, function as a whole. And literally, I've had several papers in which the inspiration wasn't a dream, like curculae with the benzene structure. I literally dreamed it up, and the papers were published in refereed journals. However, I didn't submit the paper and say, I literally dreamed this up. I'm sure they would have rejected it.
All right. Earlier in the program, you mentioned consciousness as the driving force.
Yeah, I've kind of begun to conclude that I think most of reality And I'll put this in some kind of a general quotes or something. Most of existence is unmanifest consciousness. And then if you look at a glass of fluid and then a little bit's precipitated out at the bottom, that 10% is like the tip of the iceberg, and that's the physical component. So I actually believe that most of it, some people would call magic, but it's consciousness of many different forms. I mean, for all animal, plant, and rocks and everything else. And I grew up on Indian land, Witten Indian land, and I always believed everything was conscious.
Mm.
I grew up in a family that did not believe that, which was brought home to me quite clearly that my belief was not, I kind of realized that my belief was not common to the people in my environment.
Well, I tell you what, it's refreshing to me because I have Lakota ancestry, and I've was taught by my grandfathers that the rocks and the stones and the trees and every damn thing out there is conscious and intelligent and capable of communication, frankly.
Well, my husband Bill was part Seminole. And then one time when I was staying with the Hopi people, I spent some time with a Lakota medicine man. And I guess in a certain way, the closest to my kind of personal philosophical thinking is probably the Native Americans and probably some of the other Native peoples that I've met. However, that doesn't go into the mathematics part and the physics part. But as far as feeling in harmony, what was interesting about Hopi land is there was no word for time in the original Hopi language, and that's true of Tibetan Buddhism, that there's no word for time, and there really was a feeling of timelessness, quite amazing, quite striking to me, and it just was like harmony. Someone would say, well, we're going over to so-and-so's house maybe in a few days for corn, and all of a sudden people would just show up. It wasn't very well organized, but everybody just seemed to be there at the right time and the right place. And it was a pattern that I saw that when my life really was working for me was this, what Carl Jung would call synchronicity.
Yeah, sure.
It would just click. It would just happen.
Well, a couple things come to mind. First of all, the relationship between the Hopi and the Tibetan people is a profound one. There's very weird, strange relationship there where they may be even related, I think, somewhere back, because they even have physical features, I think, that are very similar. But they have a unique relationship, and I know that the Dalai Lama himself was very interested in visiting with some of the grandfathers in Hopi land not too long ago, and I think there's something going on there. But
actually, my work on complex Minkowski spaces, which are related to extending Maxwell's equations to non-Hertzian phenomena, someone gave a book of mine to the Dalai Lama on that topic. Don't know if he read it or not. But yeah, I've noticed that from studying Tibetan Buddhism, and that the feeling I get, I guess the sense of peace and harmony between those beliefs seem to be very similar in some nature. Yes, I very strongly agree with it. I wonder also, you know, I think we have not really realized how much information was communicated around the globe in ancient history. Like the base site of the Sun Pyramid in Mexico is almost identical to the base site of Cheops' pyramid.
In Giza, yeah.
And I don't think that's an accident.
I think you're right. I think you're right. I think that there was a time in the past that maybe we've been either forgotten or the information has been lost, or we're in, like Emmanuel Velikovsky said, you know, people in amnesia or something. But there seems to be all kinds of signs that show that there was some sort of global communication and maybe even travel and trade and all kinds of things.
Yeah, I think there's also telepathy, but I believe that there were many technical discoveries in the past that have been lost, because if you think of looking through the rubble of this civilization 2,000 or 3,000 years from now, isn't going to be that much left of computers. And
That's true.
Joked with the people at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, because the accelerator was surrounded by these huge concrete blocks with iron rebar in them. And I thought to myself, it's in a circle, and they'll probably think it's some kind of religious temple. So yes. Paul caught on to that and did the Muslim call to prayer.
You know, it's an amazing thing that you say that, because if you look at places like Tevatron, you know, or the Argonne lab and some of these big particle accelerators and atom smashers, you know, they actually look very reminiscent to, if you go to the Kaaba in Mecca and look at the layout of the land, you have the big black cube right in the middle, you know?
Yeah.
And then this circular thing all around. Oh, my God, Tevatron looks exactly like it, frankly.
Yeah, I think it looks kind of like some kind of the Stonehenge.
I mean,
it's very interesting to me, because I've seen the crystal skulls, like the Hedges skull, but I have not seen the spark plug that's supposed to be actually incorporated into a rock.
Right, right. And it's supposed to be a million years old or something like that.
Yes.
Right,
and then there's
right.
Then in Egypt they discovered these little vessels that were made out of some form of terracotta, and then they actually had a wrap of copper inside with a central iron rod, and if you just put vinegar in there, as someone pointed out, if you pee in it, you can get about a 1.5-volt battery.
There you go.
I mean, you just put those together, and as long as you can invent a flashlight bulb of some sort, which probably was more like a fluorescent light than an incandescent light if they did that, but in the Egyptian temples, there's no smoke from burning fires from torches, and they were clearly painted in place because the painting goes across the corners in a place that would be completely dark.
Mm-hmm.
And people thought, well, maybe they had big lenses to try to guide sunlight in there. But in some cases, this explanation doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's too bad the Library of Alexandria were destroyed.
Yeah.
And the codices of the Mayans.
Yes.
It just must have been such wonderful, fantastic knowledge. And I think it's egocentric of each civilization to think they're the best.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, we have to give due respect to, I think, a tremendous amount of knowledge that's been obtained and lost and can probably, to some degree, be reobtained again.
I agree with you, and you know, it's an amazing thing when you really look back at some of this stuff, and you know, the closer you look, the more interesting it gets. You mentioned the pyramids, and we were talking about Lakota people before. Well, one of my grandfathers, who I consider a shaman and a medicine man, who was just a wonderful, wonderful person, his name was Wallace Black Elk, and he told me a story one time about the construction of the pyramids in Egypt, and at least his understanding based on what he was taught about what happened there. And he prefaced the story with something that you made me think about, and he talked about technology, and he said, you know, Mike, the more advanced technology gets, the smaller it gets. And so over time, small things get lost really easily. you know.
That's true.
And then he said, you know, in Giza, he said, you know, engineers have wondered for millennia, how did they do this or whatever. He said, I was taught that they levitated these stones somehow, and that they had, he described it as a whistle. And he said it was an ultrasonic device. It was a sound, a device that used sound. And by changing the frequency of the sound, the thing could cut granite, or it could levitate. It could do, you know, many different things, but it was all based on these applications of sound. And he said, you know, the trick was they didn't build it from the ground up. They built it from the top down.
I've heard of that. And you know what? You know, like the opera singer that hits a certain frequency and breaks a glass.
Yeah, sure.
And then now they do the lipotripsy for kidney stones.
Mm-hmm.
And that's purely based on trying to find a resonant sound frequency that will granulate the kidney stone.
Right, just shatter the thing, sure.
And if it's a small enough gallstone, they can do it for gallstones. So that certainly is a sonic technology. And whether that could be used to cut rock, I would tend to not believe in what I call the Cecil B. DeMille's model with all the slaves.
Right. I don't think so either.
I don't think so. But you know, another person that is of interest that you mentioned earlier was Velikovsky.
Oh, Emmanuel Velikovsky, one of my heroes.
Emmanuel Velikovsky, and I read his book Worlds in Collision.
Sure.
And at the time I was teaching at Berkeley, and I use this as an example for censorship, which still goes on greatly.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Macmillan, was going to publish World in Collisions, but some of the astronomers from Cornell said they never published with Macmillan if they published Velikovsky's World in Collisions. So they went back on their word, and he got another publisher, mm-hmm. but they would ended on their contract with him.
Well, that's amazing because, you know, frankly, they're still up to that business at Cornell. And that Archive X that they call it, the online archive of peer review and stuff, I know some very gifted scientists that because their views are particularly this or that, they have been completely denied, you know, exposure through that particular medium. And I think it's...
I think so. Now, of course, I also see this. The whole Internet, in fact, I downloaded a couple of papers by some Germans that had done some experiments that indicated faster-than-light signaling in some experiments. I just downloaded them today,
uh-huh.
and I haven't read them in detail, but they were on YouTube.
Huh.
It's not necessarily a physics journal, but...
Right, but it's a way to move information.
That might begin to shift some of the... See, it's a combination. The peer review process is double-sorted. In one side, it is true that there's... I used to receive what they did at the lab since I was into some unusual stuff like psychic phenomena. I remember that the head of the physics department gave me a chapter from Fritjof Capra before he published the Tao of Physics, and he said,
that's an
here, this
book,
looks
yeah.
like your stuff. And he kind of handed it to me. And I managed to get Fritjof Capra invited to Lawrence Berkeley to work on S-Matrix, and then he finished publishing his book with Shambhala.
Mm.
But there are, and I would get really... pretty, a guy had a book based on F equals MA squared or something. You know, in other words, his basic assumption was really wrong, and his conclusions, therefore, were incorrect. But there also is some imaginative physics that should be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like these papers on YouTube, you know, I need to study them to see what I think of it, and then I'm going to correspond with these physicists in Germany.
Right,
but
I think
there's going to be a sort of a new ball game here where...
Well, the playing field is being leveled quite a bit, I think.
I hope so, because I feel like When I published papers that were pretty conventional, that just an additional, you know, like when I worked on my PhD thesis mm-hmm. and I published parts of that,
right.
it was a step ahead and actually got kind of a lot of good attention. But as long as it was pretty relatively conventional, you send it off to physical review and you get a card back saying they received it, and a few weeks later they accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you went outside the norm, like some of the stuff I did on black hole physics in the early 70s,
right.
man,
forget
some
it,
journals, huh? I was trying to explain why I was doing the physics, and man, they had big red lines through everything. And by the time it got done, the paper was so short that I rewrote it and sent it to another journal.
Right.
But sometimes... even slightly different is pretty hard to get it published.
Right.
And I also found this. I used to publish under Elizabeth Rauscher, and then I stopped doing that. I published many of my papers under E.A.
E.A. I've seen that many times under some of your publications, E.A. Rauscher, sure.
Yes, I found the odds of getting it accepted improved.
Isn't that interesting, huh?
I'd say significantly. Probably...
Yeah.
About 70% to 80% increase in chance.
Ah, that's the old male dominance hierarchy at work, I guess.
Yes.
All right, Elizabeth, we have 30 minutes, and it's up to you. We can either take a short break for about 3 minutes, or we can just keep right on going.
Whatever you want, fine with me.
Well, I don't get this opportunity that often, so I say we just keep going.
Fine with me.
All right, something that... Before we go any further, I've got something interesting I want to ask you about the Hopi. There are people that talk about the legend of the Kachina and the moving into the fifth world and this sort of thing, and the idea that the Hopi see great change on the horizon, as many indigenous peoples do, and I guess even we're all indigenous at this point. But at any rate, the Kachina story, and I was going to ask you if you know anything about this comet that has been pretty interesting over the last 30 days or so, Comet Holmes, that had a...
I've heard about that, and it's supposed to have remained, you know, as the comet comes by the sun, the solar effect increases the excitation of the gases and the ice within the comet head, but this one's supposed to have remained much brighter than they would expect as it moves away from the sun.
Yeah, this one actually had its outburst when it was sort of at its farthest distance. It's one of these comets that doesn't even leave the solar system. It never goes out further than Jupiter's orbit or so, but it was nice and calm when it went around the sun, and then when it got out by in between Mars and Jupiter, the thing in 24 hours brightened by a magnitude of 750,000.
Yeah, I heard it was amazing, and I think that's very interesting to follow. Comets, you know, of course, in the old days, they were thought to be the hand of God.
Harbingers of something.
And harbingers of something, but on the other hand, they could be the hand of God, but also a ball of gas and dust and ice. But Hale Bopp was interesting, because when we went out, we lived in Illinois at the time, but you could drive out in the country and find an old farm road, and it was weird. It looked like a hole in the sky. It was a very strange-looking comet.
Interesting.
It was just very strange-looking, but... it's interesting. It was kind of, you know, I've been waiting for Halley's Comet since I was a little kid and heard about it.
Right.
And then it kind of wasn't too spectacular. But they're very unusual. And I think the belt of debris between Mars and Jupiter may have been an exploded planet, you know, asteroid belt. But... it's hard to say. I would say this, though. You know, the Hopi say they're in charge of the heart of the Mother Earth. And that there's these big underground veins of the Earth. And I found government reports to prove their point, because I was trying to help prevent the coal and uranium strip mining that was using ruining the water supply for both the Hopi and Navajo people.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And with some other people, I managed to get help from the Baron and Baroness DePauli to write to get some attorneys to stop the strip mining for about 15 years. And then some of the tailings got loose from the uranium strip mining, and about 10% of some of the Navajo children were very disfigured.
Yeah.
But and so they started the mining again, but it has been permanently stopped, as I understand at this point.
Good. Good work.
But I
Thank
did
you for
find
that.
That indeed there's these huge underground rivers. And it's so radical that it's so contrary to standard geophysics, it's not very well believed, but
mm-hmm.
in government reports. And I don't know if you've been to Death Valley and seen Devil's Hole.
Well, I've been to, yeah, I haven't seen it directly, but I've been there. I've been close.
There's some holes that are empty. There's no water. But my Devil's Hole is about maybe 50 or 60 feet across,
mm-hmm.
and it's just this most beautiful turquoise blue hole. And there's a fence around it, so you're not supposed to go in there, but as a young person just in my very early 20s, I went in there with my first husband, and we swam in it. It was actually about 90 degrees. It was fantastic.
Huh.
And then we kind of disconnected a thing that measured the fluctuation of the surface of the water, so I just didn't have data for a while. Climbed back over the barbed wire fence, and I had heard people had gone down there with scuba gear on cables and got swept away and ended up in holes miles away.
Holy cow, there's a current down there in a river.
And I think that some of these small islands, like in the Bahamas,
mm.
and those areas are, how could they get fresh water when they're so small that the rainfall wouldn't really collect to give them enough
right,
water?
Right, right, right.
And they
a lot
do,
of them.
And they do, and they have fresh water mm-hmm. coming up in artesian wells. It's just amazing.
Yeah, right there in the middle of the ocean, yeah.
So how does that happen? And actually, in some cases, some of the bodies were found out in the Gulf of Mexico, so the Hopi were right about these, and some of these go like 30 miles an hour. You wouldn't think it was possible mm. in the hole, and whether they're old lava tubes or not. But the San Francisco Mountains, where the Kachina spirits are supposed to reside, are volcanic in nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that the native peoples view that there's going to, I feel this way, there was a possibility for a more gentle transition in mm. the 60s towards a more ecologically and environmentally friendly reality,
mm-hmm.
but that path wasn't taken. It was like two paths, and
mm-hmm.
and the surfacing of what needed to be done wasn't taken. So although that path has presented itself again, because it's so much later and so many things have gone on in the meantime,
hmm.
I think it's going to be a much harder
transition.
Reality to yeah. make this transition
hmm.
that needs to be made for a man to survive.
Right. I mean, we're literally at in a practical sense, an evolutionary junction here where, you know, we've gone as far as we can go with the certain set of tools that we've been using, and something has to change in order for us to continue, it seems.
Definitely, and it's got to be, you know, what I see is it's got to have something to do with kindness and gentleness.
Mm.
At 15, I thought, you know,
it's true.
When I was young, I didn't realize World War II had just happened.
Hmm.
And I couldn't believe that. I thought people were more civilized, and I had this idea that I would figure out how to end war, although I do agree that there was no choice in World War II because Hitler did say he was going to take over the planet, and he meant to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Saddam Hussein said that,
I don't think so.
But he was pretty crazy, but he didn't declare he was going to take over the world. But I thought of, you know, kindness, peace, love, and joy would be a lot better than war, crime, and violence. But I don't think I've made much headway on the war issue.
You know, it's interesting, the work of Darwin, you know. I don't know if you ever read his the work that followed Origin of the Species. He wrote another book that he spent pretty much the rest of his life on. It was called The Descent of Man.
Yes.
And that in that particular publication, he talks about man, you know, and about how we are sort of the fly in the ointment when it comes to the models that were talked about in his first work. But in the Origin of the Species, the word love is not used one time. And in Descent of Man, it's used 74 or 75 times. And he actually saw what you just said in an evolutionary sense, that it would be love and kindness and compassion that would be the defining sense of the evolutionary character of man.
I think so. And even when I was little and I realized that the idea of biological evolution made some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And there are even models that I worked on where there's repeated segments of DNA that may be written on from the phenotype or the environment to the genotype.
Uh-huh.
I thought, well, that should mean that something will evolve out of man. If you think about it, what's the next thing going to be? What will come after, animal, vegetable, and mineral? I mean, something else will evolve.
Mm.
I don't know what it will be or what it will look like. And even all the sci-fi stuff, they kind of combine stuff we already know about.
Right.
But I talked to my husband, and I sort of wondered whether man would destroy the earth or whether nature would take its cut, but I think he's right, that nature will take its cut and man has to change.
I think so, too, and I think that it's a little bit, actually not a little bit, but quite hubristic for us to assume, first of all, that we have control of things on the planet, and secondly, that we can, you know, somehow rests it and maintain it, and that we're actually running the show. And I think that we have a part to play, and if we do the right things, perhaps, you know, we can continue. But I certainly don't particularly think that we're running the show.
No, I don't think so either. And I think what went wrong was the word dominion over nature to me meant to take care of
to be a gardener,
assistant, not to dominate.
Yeah, domination and dominion are different words. Yes, yes, yes.
And I think that the misuse of that word by Western civilization has caused a great deal of the catastrophes that are being suffered now by people throughout the world, not just the developed nations.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel this way. Technology is so complex, but it's still a thin facade. It isn't something that's fundamentally changing the nature of humans. However, some of it might, but it doesn't, you know, the fundamental problems of greed and jealousy,
right,
and hatred,
right,
and competition for, you know, fight religious wars and territory and oil, somehow there's got to be a totally new way of dealing with that.
Right, right. Yeah, technology gets blamed a lot, but people think that technology is something new, but I mean, the chipping of the first flint was technology, you know? And it's always been utilized in this way or that way, and it's a matter of how we implement the technology, how we use it, the wisdom behind, you know, how we use this technology that sort of defines our success or our failure as a species, I think.
And we're finding, you know, birds using little twigs to stick them in to get bugs on them, and they shape the twigs.
Right.
Also, there was one group of chimpanzee, and the dominant alpha male was beating his wife with a branch.
Nice guy. Sound
on
familiar?
A regular basis. So.
Well, the dolphins, you know, they use a real technology in the way they manipulate sound and the mastery of their environment. My God.
Oh, it's amazing. I had a fantastic time swimming with the dolphins. Mm. And talk about immediate communication.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
You have just thought, and it's just reacted upon by immediately. I saw a pod that was about, I was skin diving, and I had swam probably, you know, for several hours. There was some nice green tortoises, and there was this pod about 80 feet down. And this will make people wonder about me, but I... wanted to see him up closely, so I said I love you three times, and I'd like to see you up close. And two dolphins, these were the spinner dolphins, came out and dove right in front of me.
Awesome.
In a big arch, and then went down. And then I did go to Dolphin Quest, which has the captive dolphins, which some people disapprove of. But I will say, when you pet the dolphins, they do close their eyes. And, you know, when you pet a dog or a cat,
sure.
and it gets contented, why, it sort of has that look in its eyes, and then it kind of closes them when it's feeling pretty good about stuff. And so that was really interesting, very fascinating. You know, I just feel like there is this instantaneous communication. And when Bill and I were living at the edge of the woods, so we had all kinds of birds, coyotes, jackrabbits, bunny rabbits. And what was interesting is the interpersonal, interspecies communication. Like, there was some birds that had long beaks for gathering worms. They were not seed eaters. But when the seed eaters were hungry, they'd come and knock on the window to say, the other guys are hungry. And then once you start feeding the seeds, then the birds would call the bunny rabbits, because they figured the pellets were getting thrown out for the bunny rabbits. And the bunny rabbits would use the birds' alert signals to decide whether to run or not. And I've never seen a rabbit lay out with its legs on the side like a cat does when it's relaxed. But they used to lay out under our truck because it seemed so safe. But they, and then Bill would use a specific call to call the quail and the other different animals. And they would use his call when they perceived danger, like from a cat. So they learned his vocabulary.
Amazing.
And then there was some blue jays. They just had so much fun. We'd hide peanuts, and they just loved to play. And they kind of would pretend to dive bomb us in the hot tub. And then one day it was really raining, and this blue jay came up with its wings hanging out because it was wet and miserable. And it looked to me like it was giving Bill a dirty look, as though he was a god and had caused the rain. I think the blue jay was blaming Bill.
The little turning of the tables there, you know?
Yeah, so funny.
Hey, let me ask you, I think we got time for one last question here, and it sort of comes full circle, actually. We're talking about animals again, and early in the program, you said something that was profound to me, because I've experienced it myself, and you talked about how animals... And I would add, plants act different when you're alone. And
oh, definitely.
I had this thought, Elizabeth, years ago about electrons. And I realized, I was told that the only way you can actually get to know an electron is you have to look at it by itself. And that if you look at a group of electrons, of course, that's an electric current. And an electric current has properties and acts a whole lot differently than an electron by itself does. And that analogy sort of hit me in the head tonight when you mentioned this idea of humans as alone. It's sort of the same thing. When you pull us out of the stream of humans and the, you know, we act completely different. We have different properties.
I think that's true. And I remember sometimes when I would hike in the woods alone, I kind of felt like there was an old Indian guide, a disincarnate spirit that would come with me. And sometimes a young spirit guide. And one thing I used to do when I was talking about atomic and molecular physics is to say, we assume all electrons are the same, or all neutrons are the same, and I call it the Nick and the neutron theory. That maybe at the scale of a neutron, if you're that size,
right,
maybe neutrons don't all look the same.
Right, they're like you and me, maybe.
They like have their individual personalities.
Mm-hmm.
We treat them because of our relative size difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting because the size of humans is sort of halfway between the smallest thing in the universe, which is the quantum foam, and the largest thing in the universe, as we know it, to be the size of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like an optical perspective enhanced by instruments. And it's very interesting to think about, you know, many of the shamanistic traditions teach you to become the animal. In other words, to become and actually take on the valence of the feeling of being a particular animal.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting process. It's very interesting. What I used to do when I walked in the woods is I didn't imagine being anything but just being.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't choose to think of myself as a human or a non-human.
Just part of the whole scene.
Just part of the whole thing as an observer within that reality. But it is interesting to, you know, one time I tried to become the cobra. I actually sort of felt like a cobra. Well, I probably didn't look like one. But I've had some animals, they're very curious, and they'll come up like a scuba diving, and a seal was looking at me, didn't know what I was.
Right.
And it kept getting closer and closer, and it would bob its head up and look, and then finally, whatever it decided I was, just about skimmed the surface of the water to get out of there. I don't know what it thought. I thought it was a sea lion.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, it has been a pleasure. It is already at the end of our time here. We went through 2 hours like nothing. And I'm going to have to turn the microphone over here to my compadre, Miss Ruth, who's going to come on the air here in a few minutes and play some music for the folks. But I have to say thank you so much, and it has been a thrill and a pleasure and a privilege, and thank you so much for everything that you're doing and for sharing some of it with us.
Well, I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate the questions that your people had emailed in. And all I can tell them is just keep up the good work and live life to its fullest. It's a gift, and enjoy it.
Well, those are words of wisdom, and I appreciate them all. And thank you very much, and I'll talk to you very soon, okay?
Okay, thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Dr. Rauscher. Take care.
Take care.
All right, everybody, it's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. How about it? Dr. Elizabeth Ann Rauscher, what a wonderful, wonderful experience, and a wonderful woman, a brilliant woman who's been doing amazing things for many, many years, and it was a pleasure to have her on the air and share some of her words of wisdom and knowledge with you all tonight. So, okay, time to run out of here. We'll finish off here with one more from John Condren and The Benefit. It's a wonderful song called Dunfanahy, and we will come back at you next week on, what is it, the 3rd of December, my gosh, with Paco Almgren, the author of Discipline. All right, stick around, Ruth and Crash Landing coming up in just a few minutes. One more time, John Condren and The Benefit, thanks for the wonderful music. Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, thank you for the wonderful conversation. And this is Dunfanahy. Stick around for Ruth and Crash Landing on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM.
I have seen you your hair. And the truth is, I've been yours alone since first I tasted air. So take me now across the sea to Holy Cross we'll ride. From now until forever, river by your side. Till October trips to sea, and the wind sings o'er the bay. I'll dream here of my only love by the church at Dunfanaghan. Now a gentle day is all I pray. Finally she arrives, and the music there will carry us, leave us man and wife. Where there's nothing in the whole of me to stop the tears that day. When first I come to see you there by the church at Dunfanaghan. Till October drifts to sleep and the wind sings o'er the bay, I'll dream here of my only love by the church at Dunfanaghan. Time's erased my former face and the vanities of now. When I may forget most everything, never what I vow. And when I'm done and over here, it's all must go away. I'll wait for you, my love, on the banks of Sheephaven Bay. Till October drifts to sleep and the wind sings o'er the bay, I'll dream here of my only love by the church at Dunfanaghan. Church at Dunfanaghan.